It was now 1:30. He was ambling back from the Mended Drum, the most determinably disreputable of the city's taverns. Victor Tugelbend always gave the impression of ambling, even when he was running. He was also quite sober, and a bit surprised, therefore, to find himself in the Plaza of Broken Moons. He'd been heading for the little alley behind the university and the piece of wall with the conveniently spaced removable bricks, where for hundreds and hundreds of years student wizards had quietly got around, or more precisely climbed over, unseen university's curfew restrictions. The plaza wasn't on the route. He turned to amble back the way he had come, and then stopped. There was something unusual going on. Usually there'd be a storyteller there, or some musicians, or an entrepreneur looking for prospective buyers of such surplus Ankh-Morpork landmarks as the Tower of Art or the Brass Bridge. Now there were just some people putting up a big screen, like a bedsheet stretched between two poles. He sauntered over to them. "What you doing?" he said amiably.
"There's going to be a performance."
"Oh, acting," said Victor without much interest. He mooched back through the damp darkness, but stopped when he heard a voice coming from the gloom between the two buildings. The voice said, "Help," quite quietly. Another voice said,
"Just hand it over, right."
Victor wandered closer and squinted into the shadows.
"Hello," he said, "is everything all right?"
There was a pause, and then a low voice said,
"You don't know what's good for you, kid."
"He's got a knife," Victor thought. "He's coming at me with a knife. That means I'm either going to get stabbed or I'm going to have to run away, which is a real waste of energy."
People who didn't apply themselves to the facts in hand might have thought that Victor Tugelbend would be fat and unhealthy. In fact, he was undoubtedly the most athletically inclined student in the university. Having to haul around extra poundage was far too much effort, and he saw to it that he never put it on, and he kept himself in trim, because doing things with decent muscles was far less effort than trying to achieve things with bags of flab. So he brought one hand round in a backhanded swipe. It didn't just connect, it lifted the mugger off his feet. Then he looked for the prospective victim, who was still cowering against the wall.
"Hope you're not hurt," he said.
"Don't move."
"I wasn't going to," said Victor.
The figure advanced from the shadows. It had a package under one arm, and its hands were held in front of its face. In an odd gesture, each forefinger and thumb extended at right angles, and then fitted together, so that the man's little weaselly eyes appeared to be looking out through a frame.
"He's probably warding off the evil eye," Victor thought. "He looks like a wizard with all those symbols on his dress."
"Amazing," said the man, squinting through his fingers. Just... "Turn your head slightly, will you? Great! Pity about the nose, but I expect we can do something about that."
He stepped forward and tried to put his arm round Victor's shoulders.
"It's lucky for you," he said, "that you met me."
"It is,"
said Victor, who had been thinking it was the other way round.
"You're just the type I'm looking for," said the man.
"Sorry," said Victor. "I thought you were being robbed."
"He was after this,"
said the man, patting the package under his arm. It rang like a gong.
"Wouldn't have done him any good, though."
"Not worth anything," said Victor.
"Priceless!"
"Well, that's all right, then," said Victor.
The man gave up trying to reach across both of Victor's shoulders, which were quite broad, and settled for just one of them.
"But a lot of people would be disappointed," he said. "Now look, you stand well. Good profile. Listen, lad. How would you like to be in moving pictures?"
Said Victor. "No, I don't think so."
The man gaped at him.
"You did hear what I said, didn't you?" he said. "Moving pictures."
"Yes,
everyone wants to be in moving pictures."
"No, thanks," said Victor politely. "I'm sure it's a worthwhile job, but moving pictures doesn't sound very interesting to me."
"I'm talking about moving pictures."
"Yes," said Victor mildly. "I heard you."
The man shook his head.
"Well," he said, "you've made my day. First time in weeks I've met someone who isn't desperate to get into moving pictures. I thought everyone wanted to get into moving pictures. I thought as soon as I saw you, he'll be expecting a job in moving pictures for this night's work."
"Thanks all the same," said Victor, "but I don't think I'd take to it." Well, I owe you something.
The little man fumbled in a pocket and produced a card. Victor took it. It read, Thomas Silverfish, Interesting and Instructive Kinematography, 1 and 2 reelers, Nearly Non-Explosive Stock, 1 Holy Wood.
That's if ever you change your mind, he said. Everyone in Holywood knows me.
Victor stared at the card.
Thank you, he said vaguely. Are you a wizard?
Silverfish glared at him.
Whatever made you think that? He snapped. Were you wearing a dress with magic symbols? Magic symbols? Look closely, boy. These are certainly not the credulous symbols of a ridiculous and outmoded belief system. These are the badges of an enlightened craft whose clear new dawn is just dawning. Magic symbols.
He finished in tones of withering scorn.
And it's a robe, not a dress, he added.
Victor peered at the collection of stars and crescent moons and things. The badges of an enlightened craft, whose new dawn was just dawning, looked just like the credulous symbols of a ridiculous and outmoded belief system to him. But this was probably not the time to say so.
Sorry, he said again. Couldn't see them clearly. I'm an alchemist, said Silverfish, only slightly mollified. Oh, lead into gold, that sort of thing, said Victor. Not lead, lad. Light. It doesn't work with lead. Light into gold.
Really,
said Victor politely, as Silverfish started to set up a tripod in the middle of the plaza. A small crowd was collecting. A small crowd collected very easily in Ankh-Morpork. As a city, it had some of the most accomplished spectators in the universe. They'd watch anything, especially if there was any possibility of anyone getting hurt in an amusing way.
"Why don't you stay for the show?" said Silverfish, and hurried off.
"An alchemist." "Well, everyone knew that alchemists were a little bit mad," thought Victor. "It was perfectly normal. Who'd want to spend their time moving pictures? Most of them looked all right where they were."
"Sausages in a bun! Get 'em while they're hot!"
bellowed a voice by his ear. He turned.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Dibbler," he said.
"Evening, lad. Want to get a nice hot sausage down you?"
Victor eyed the glistening tubes in the tray around Dibbler's neck. They smelled appetizing. They always did. And then you bit into them and learned once again that cut-me-own-throat Dibbler could find a use for bits of animal that the animal didn't even know it had got. Dibbler had worked out that with enough fried onions and mustard, people would eat anything.
"Special rate for students," Dibbler whispered conspiratorially. 15 pence, and that's cutting me own throat."
He flapped the frying pan lid strategically, raising a cloud of steam. The piquant scent of fried onions did its wicked work.
"Just one, then," said Victor warily.
Dibbler flicked a sausage out of the pan and snatched it into a bun with the expertise of a frog snapping a mayfly.
"You won't live to regret it," he said cheerfully.
Victor nibbled a bit of onion. That was safe enough.
"What's all this?"
he said, jerking a thumb in the direction of the flapping screen.
"Some kind of entertainment," said Dibbler. "Hot sausages, they're lovely!"
He lowered his voice again to its normal conspiratorial hiss.
"All the rage in the other cities, I hear," he added. "Some sort of moving pictures. They've been trying to get it right before coming to Ankh-Morpork."
They watched Silverfish and a couple of associates fumble technically with the box on the tripod. White light suddenly appeared at a circular orifice on the front of it and illuminated the screen. There was a half-hearted cheer from the crowd.
"Oh," said Victor, "I see. Is that all? It's just plain old shadow play. That's all it is. My uncle used to do it to amuse me. You know, you kind of move your hands in front of the light and the shadows make a kind of silhouette-y picture."
"Oh, yeah," said Dibbler, uncertainly. "Like big elephant or bald eagle. My grandpa used to do that sort of stuff."
"Mainly my uncle did deformed rabbit," said Victor. "He wasn't very good at it, you see. It used to get pretty embarrassing. We'd all sit round desperately guessing things like surprised hedgehog or rabid stoat. And he'd go off to bed in a sulk because we hadn't guessed he was really doing Lord Henry Skips and his men beating the trolls at the Battle of Pseudopolis. I can't see what's so special about shadows on a screen.
"'From what I hear, it's not like that,' said Dibbler. "'I sold one of the men a jumbo sausage special earlier on, "'and he said it's all down to showing pictures very fast, "'sticking lots of pictures together "'and showing them one after the other very, very fast,' he said.
"'Not too fast,' said Victor severely. "'You wouldn't be able to see them go past if they were too fast.'
"'He said that's the whole secret. "'Not seeing them go past,' said Dibbler. "'You have to see them all at once or something.'
"'They'd all be blurred,' said Victor. "'Didn't you ask him about that?'
"'Nah,' said Dibbler. "'Point of fact, he had to rush off just then, said he felt a bit odd.'
Victor looked thoughtfully at the remnant of his sausage in a bun, and as he did so he was aware of being stared at in his turn. He looked down. There was a dog sitting by his feet. It was small, bow-legged and wiry, and basically grey, but with patches of brown, white and black in outlying areas, and it was staring. It was certainly the most penetrating stare Victor had ever seen. It wasn't menacing or fawning, it was just very slow and very thorough, as though the dog was memorizing details so that it could give a full description to the authorities later on. When it was sure it had his full attention, it transferred its gaze to the sausage. Feeling wretched at being so cruel to a poor, dumb animal, Victor flicked the sausage downwards. The dog caught and swallowed it in one economical movement. More people were drifting into the plaza now. Cut-me-own-throat Dibbler had wandered off, and was doing a busy trade with those late-night revellers who were too drunk to prevent optimism triumphing over experience. Anyone who bought a meal at 1 a.m. after a night's revelling was probably going to be riotously ill anyway, so they might as well have something to show for it. Victor was gradually surrounded by a large crowd. It didn't consist solely of humans. He recognized a few feet away the big rangy shape of Detritus, an ancient troll well known to all the students as someone who found employment anywhere people needed to be thrown very hard out of places for money. The troll noticed him and tried to wink. This involved closing both eyes because Detritus wasn't good at complicated things. It was widely believed that if Detritus could be taught to read and write sufficiently to sit down and do an intelligence test, he'd prove to be slightly less intelligent than the chair. Silverfish picked up a megaphone.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "you are privileged tonight to witness a turning point in the history of the century of..."
He lowered the megaphone, and Victor heard him whisper urgently to one of his assistants.
"What century is this, is it?"
And then raised the megaphone again and continued in the original plummily optimistic tones.
"Century of the fruit bat. No less than the birth of moving pictures. Pictures that move without magic."
He waited for the applause. There wasn't any. The crowd just watched him. You needed to do more than end your sentences with an exclamation mark to get a round of applause from an Ankh-Morpork crowd. Slightly dispirited, he went on.
"Seeing is believing, they say. But, ladies and gentlemen, you will not believe the evidence of your own eyes. What you are about to witness is a triumph of natural science, a marvel of the age, a discovery of world, nay, dare I say, universe-shaking proportions."
"It's got to be better than that bloody sausage anyways," said a quiet voice by Victor's knee.
"Harnessing natural mechanisms to create illusion. Illusion, ladies and gentlemen, without recourse to magic."
Victor let his gaze slide downwards. There was nothing down there but the little dog industriously scratching itself. It looked up slowly and said, "Woof."
"Potential for learning, the arts, history. I thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, you ain't seen nothing yet."
There was another hopeful break for applause. Someone at the front of the crowd said,
"That's right, we ain't."
"Yeah," said the woman next to him. "When you going to stop going on like that and get on with the shadow play?"
"That's right," snapped a second woman. "Do Deformed Rabbit. My kids always loved that one."
Victor looked away for a while to lull the dog's suspicions and then turned and glared hard at it. It was amiably watching the crowd and apparently taking no notice of him. Victor poked an exploratory finger in his ear. It must have been a trick of an echo or something. It wasn't that the dog had gone woof, although that was practically unique in itself. Most dogs in the universe never went woof. They had complicated barks like woof and woof woof. No, it was that it hadn't in fact barked at all. It had said woof. He shook his head and looked back as Silverfish climbed down from the screen and motioned to one of his assistants to start turning a handle at the side of the box. There was a grinding noise that rose to a steady clicking. Vague shadows danced across the screen, and then... One of the last things Victor remembered was a voice beside his knee saying, "Could have been worse, mister. I could have said meow." Holywood Dreams. And now it was 8 hours later. A horribly overhung Ponder Stibbons looked guiltily at the empty desk beside him. It was unlike Victor to miss exams. He always said he enjoyed the challenge.
"Get ready to turn over your papers," said the invigilator at the end of the hall.
The 60 chests of 60 prospective wizards tightened with dark, unbearable tension. Ponder fumbled anxiously with his lucky pen. The wizard on the dais turned over the hourglass.
"You may begin," he said.
Several of the more smug students turned over their papers by snapping their fingers. Ponder hated them instantly. He reached for his lucky inkwell, missed completely in his nervousness, and then knocked it over. A small black flood rolled over his question paper. Panic and shame washed over him nearly as thoroughly. He mopped up the ink with the hem of his robe, spreading it smoothly over the desk. His lucky dried frog had been washed away. Hot with embarrassment, dripping black ink, he looked up in supplication at the presiding wizard, and then cast his eyes imploringly at the empty desk beside him. The wizard nodded. Ponder gratefully sidled across the aisle, waited until his heart had stopped thumping, and then very carefully turned over the paper on the desk. After 10 seconds, and against all reason, he turned it over again, just in case there'd been a mistake, and the rest of the questions had somehow been on the top side after all. Around him there was the intense silence of 59 minds creaking with sustained effort. Ponder turned the paper over again. Perhaps it was some mistake. No, there was the university seal and the signature of the Arts Chancellor and everything. So perhaps it was some sort of special test. Perhaps they were watching him now to see what he'd do. He peered around furtively. The other students seemed to be working hard. Perhaps it was a mistake, after all. Yes, the more he came to think about it, the more logical it seemed. The Arch-Chancellor had probably signed the papers, and then, when the clerks had been copying them out, one of them had got as far as the all-important first question, and then maybe had been called away or something, and no one had noticed. And it had got put on Victor's desk. But now he wasn't here, and Ponder had got it, which meant he decided in a sudden rush of piety that the gods must have wanted him to get it. After all, it wasn't his fault if some sort of error gave him a paper like this. It was probably sacrilegious or something to ignore the opportunity. They had to accept what you put down. Ponder hadn't shared the room with the world's greatest authority on examination procedures without learning a thing or two. He looked again at the question. "What is your name?" He answered it. After a while, he underlined it several times with his lucky ruler. After a little while longer, to show willing, he wrote above it, "The answer to question one is..." After a further 10 minutes, he ventured, "Which is what my name is," on the line below, and underlined it. "Poor old Victor will be really sorry he missed this," he thought. "I wonder where he is." There was no road to Holywood yet. Anyone trying to get there would take the highway to Quirm, and at some unmarked point out in the scrubby landscape would turn off and strike out towards the sand dunes. Wild lavender and rosemary lined the banks. There was no sound but the buzzing of bees and the distant song of a skylark, which only made the silence more obvious. Victor Tugelbend left the road at the point where the bank had been broken down and flattened by the passage of many carts, and by the look of it, an increasing number of feet. There were still many miles to go. He trudged on. Somewhere at the back of his mind, a tiny voice was saying things like, "Where am I? Why am I doing this?" And another part of him knew that he didn't really have to do it at all. like the hypnotist's victim, who knows they're not really hypnotized and can snap out of it any time they like, but just happened not to feel like it right now. He let his feet be guided. He wasn't certain why. He just knew that there was something that he had to be part of, something that might never happen again. Some way behind, but catching up fast, was cut-me-own-throat Dibbler trying to ride a horse. He was not a natural horseman, and fell off occasionally, which was one reason why he hadn't overtaken Victor yet. The other was that he had paused before leaving the city to sell his sausage-in-a-bun business cheaply to a dwarf, who could not believe his luck. After actually trying some of the sausages, would still not be able to believe his luck. Something was calling Dibbler, and it had a golden voice. A long way behind Throat, knuckles dragging in the sand, was Detritus the Troll. It's hard to be certain of what he was thinking, any more than it's possible to tell what a homing pigeon is thinking. He just knew that where he ought to be was not where he was. And finally, even further down the road, was an 8-horse wagon taking a load of lumber to Holywood. Its driver wasn't thinking about anything very much, although he was slightly puzzled by an incident that occurred just as he was leaving Ankh Morpork in the darkness before dawn. A voice from the gloom by the road had shouted, "Stop in the name of the city guard!" And he had stopped, and when nothing further had transpired, he had looked around, and there was no one there. The wagon rumbled past, revealing to the eye of the imaginative beholder the small figure of Gaspode the Wonder Dog, trying to make himself comfortable among the bulks of timber at the rear. He was going to Holywood too. And he also didn't know why, but he was determined to find out.
"No one would have believed, in the final years of the century of the Fruit Bat, that Discworld affairs were being watched keenly and impatiently by intelligences greater than man's, or at least much nastier, that their affairs were being scrutinized and studied as a man with a 3-day appetite might study the all-you-can-gobble-for-a-dollar menu outside Harger's House of Ribs."
Well, actually, most wizards would have believed it, if anyone had told them, and the librarian would certainly have believed it. And Mrs. Marietta Cosmopolite, of 3 Quirm Street, Ankh Morpork, would have believed it too. But she believed the world was round, that a sprig of garlic in her underwear drawer kept away vampires, and that it did you good to get out and have a laugh occasionally, that there was niceness in everyone, if you only knew where to look, and that 3 horrible little dwarfs peered in at her undressing every night. She was right about that, but only by coincidence.
Holywood was nothing very much yet, just a hill by the sea, and on the other side of the hill, a lot of sand dunes. It was that special sort of beautiful area which is only beautiful if you can leave after briefly admiring its beauty and go somewhere else, where there are hot tubs and cold drinks. Actually staying there for any length of time is a penance. Nevertheless, there was a town there, just. Wooden shacks had been built wherever someone had dropped a load of timber, and they were crude, as if the builders had resented the time taken from something more important that they'd much rather be doing. They were square plank boxes, except for the front. If you wanted to understand Holywood, Victor said years afterwards, you had to understand its buildings. You'd see a box on the sand. It'd have a roughly peaked roof, but that wasn't important because it never rained in Holywood. There'd be cracks in the walls stuffed with old rags. The windows would be holes. Glass was too fragile to cart all the way from Ankh Morpork, and from behind, the front was just like a huge wooden billboard held up by a network of struts. From the front, it was a fretted, carved, painted, ornate Baroque architectural extravaganza. In Ankh Morpork, sensible men built their houses plain so as not to attract attention, and kept the decoration for inside. But Holywood wore its houses inside out. Victor walked up what passed for the main street in a daze. He had woken up in the early hours out in the dunes. Why? He decided to come to Holywood, but why? He couldn't remember. All he could remember was that at the time it was the obvious thing to do. There had been hundreds of good reasons, if only he could remember one of them. Not that his mind had any room to review memories. It was too busy being aware that he was very hungry and acutely thirsty. His pockets had yielded a total of 7 pence. That wouldn't buy a bowl of soup, let alone a good meal. He needed a good meal. Things would look a lot clearer after a good meal. He pushed through the crowds. Most of them seemed to be carpenters, but there were others, carrying carboys or mysterious boxes, and everyone was moving very quickly and resolutely, bent on some powerful purpose of their own, except him. He trailed up the impromptu street, gawping at the houses, feeling like a stray grasshopper in an anthill. And there didn't seem to...
"Why don't you look where you're going?"
He rebounded off a wall. When he got his balance, the other party in the collision had already whirred off into the crowd. He stared for a moment and then ran desperately after her.
"Hey," he said. "Sorry. Excuse me, miss."
She stopped and waited impatiently as he caught up.
"Well?"
she said. She was a foot shorter than him, and her shape was doubtful, since most of her was covered in a ridiculously frilly dress, although the dress wasn't as ludicrous as the big blonde wig full of ringlets. And her face was white, with makeup, apart from the eyes, which were heavily ringed in black. The general effect was of a lampshade that hadn't been getting much sleep lately.
"Well," she repeated, "hurry up, they're shooting again in 5 minutes.
She unbent slightly.
"No, don't tell me," she said. "You've just got here. It's all new to you. You don't know what to do. You're hungry. You haven't got any money, right?"
"Yes. How did you know?"
"Everyone starts like that, and now you want to break into the cliques, right?"
"The cliques?"
She rolled her eyes deep within their black circles.
"Moving pictures."
"Oh.
I do," he thought. "I didn't know it, but I do. Yes, that's why I came here. Why didn't I think of that?"
"Yes," he said. "Yes, that's what I want to do. I want to, break in. And how does one do that?"
"One waits forever and ever until one is noticed."
The girl looked him up and down with unconcealed contempt.
"Take up carpentry, why don't you? Hollywood always needs good wood butchers."
And then she spun around and was gone, lost in a crowd of busy people.
Thank you," Victor called after her. "Thank you."
He raised his voice and added,
"I hope your eyes get better."
He jingled the coins in his pocket.
Well, carpentry was out. It sounded too much like hard work. He tried it once, and Wood and him had soon reached an agreement. He wouldn't touch it, and it wouldn't split.
Waiting forever and ever had its attractions, but you needed money to do it with. His fingers closed around a small, unexpected rectangle. He pulled it out and looked at it. Silverfish's card. Number 1, Holywood, turned out to be a couple of shacks inside a high fence. There was a queue at the gate. It was made up of trolls, dwarfs, and humans. They looked as though they had been there for some time. In fact, some of them had such a naturally dispirited way of sagging while remaining upright that they might have been specially evolved descendants of the original prehistoric queuers. At the gate was a large, heavy-set man who was eyeing the queue with the smug look of minor power-wielders everywhere.
"Excuse me," Victor began.
"Mr. Silverfish ain't hiring any more people this morning,"
said the man out of the corner of his mouth.
"So scram."
"But he said that if ever I was in..."
"Did I just say scram, friend?"
"Yes, but..."
The door in the fence opened a fraction. A small, pale face poked out.
"We need a troll and a couple of humans," it said. "One day, usual rates."
The gate shut again. The man straightened up and cupped his scarred hands around his mouth.
"Right, you horrible lot," he shouted. "You heard the man."
He ran his eyes over the line with the practiced gaze of a stock breeder.
"You, you, and you,"
he said, pointing.
"Excuse me," said Victor hopefully, "but I think that man over there was actually first in the queue."
He was shoved out of the way. The lucky three shuffled in. He thought he saw the glint of coins changing hands. Then the gatekeeper turned an angry red face towards him.
"You," he said, "get to the end of the queue and stay there."
Victor stared at him. He stared at the gate. He looked at the long line of dispirited people.
No, he said. "I don't think so. Thanks all the same."
"Then beat it."
Victor gave him a friendly smile. He walked to the end of the fence and followed it. It turned at the far end into a narrow alley. Victor searched among the usual alley debris for a while until he found a piece of scrap paper. Then he rolled up his sleeves, and only then did he inspect the fence carefully until he found a couple of loose boards that with a bit of effort let him through. This brought him into an area stacked with lumber and piles of cloth. There was no one around. walking purposefully in the knowledge that no one with their sleeves rolled up who walks purposefully with a piece of paper held conspicuously in their hand is ever challenged, he set out across the wood and canvas wonderland of interesting and instructive kinematography.